We hear a lot of perspectives on the Mankind podcast. Inclusion of a guest is not an endorsement of their views, and the opinions expressed here do not always represent the mission or values of the Mankind Project USA.
Looks like the rain has gone.
G'day and welcome to another episode of the Mankind podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Clift. And this is the show where we break the molds of modern manhood to prove there is more than one way to be a man. And boy, do we do that today with my guest, Christopher Hemmings. Now, Chris Hemmings is a Mancunian, meaning he is a man from Manchester. This fact alone connotes a number of characteristics about how he grew up: proud, scrappy, and very much coded into a particular kind of British manhood. In fact, British manhood is pretty much the same side of the coin as Australian manhood, which is very much kind of the man box that we talk about. You know, take things on the chin, don't show your emotions. At my school, it was, if you were a rugby player, you were on top of the pecking order of value because you showed that toughness and strength. Now, Chris comes on. He actually has joined us before for episode 51, where we spoke about his book, how macho culture is damaging boys and men. Great episode. I recommend you check it out. But since we last spoke with him, a couple things have happened. In fact, a couple things that shook him to his absolute core. A man who is quite highly regarded as a professional speaker, going into schools and touching the hearts of boys and men to talk to them about the dangers of conforming to the man box, talking and shedding light on the horrible statistics around male suicide. And yet this, what occurred and what we're going to talk about in this episode, shook him so hard that he himself questioned taking his own life. So we talk a lot in this one. This is a longer episode than you're probably used to, but man, it is thick, it's juicy, it's got a lot of gold. We talk about why it's hard to advocate for challenges facing men, which is an interesting one because it's challenging to approach at times, because now as we're raising much needed awareness for the equity, for the betterment of communities, BIPOC communities, for LGBTQIA, as we're doing that, as we're growing that awareness, it's becoming common that if you advocate for the needs of men, whether they be white, black, straight, gay, by advocating for those needs of men, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, many just assume that you are anti anyone who isn't a man. And it's this binary thinking that is creating a lot more division and a lot more challenge in the world. And so we hope to, I believe we really achieve kind of flipping that narrative on its head and speaking openly about the many challenges that are facing men that we have to speak about, we have to be vocal about, we have to get the attention out there. Otherwise, we're going to see these horrible statistics continue to grow. More men taking their lives, greater disconnection, more men becoming the perpetrators against those who don't identify as male. So I believe you're going to love this interview. It was a powerful one. I really honor and welcome Chris's courage to come in for this interview. And so, man, I'll leave it to you guys. Give us your opinions on this interview and what we cover. My interview with Chris Hemmings. Enjoy. Chris Hemmings, mate, welcome back to the Mankind podcast. How you doing, brother?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. Yeah. It's been an interesting time for me since last we spoke, let's put it that way. We have much to catch up upon.
Absolutely.
But generally I am in a very good place. In fact, you know what? I seem to find myself in the best mental, emotional well-being headspace that I've been in my entire life. That is a result of some of the experiences that I've had and the work that I've had to do on myself. It's a result of a variety of different things, but generally, you know what? I can't complain. So thank you.
There you go.
And you know, I have a burning question that I wanted to ask you because this was delayed, this podcast. We were supposed to speak a couple of weeks ago, but a little thing happened to you, right? So how's fatherhood treating you?
Fatherhood, wow. Man, it's, dude, it's the single greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Leading into parenthood, I had all these like thoughts in my head of like, oh, I hear all these cliches, like you'll never be the same. When they put that person, little person in your arms, like your life will change immediately. And so I tried to theoretically prepare myself to go, oh, I can mentally understand that, sure. But the little like kind of arrogant voice in my head was like, whatever, it'll be a different experience, I don't know. She gets put in my arms, little Bindi gets put in my arms, and man, dude, it's like, that's a baby, not that's my baby, that's a baby. And then like an hour goes by and I'm like, that's my baby. And then 2 hours go by and I'm like, that's my baby. And then just now we're we just finally hit 4 weeks since she was born. And man, she's, dude, it's rocked my world. Absolutely rocked my world. I've never been more in love with a little human, and I've never been more in love with my wife too. It's just been such an incredible experience, and she's an amazing baby. She lets us sleep. She's adorable. She's just started cracking smiles. She's just started doing what sound like grown-up farts, which gives us endless chuckles because I'm a big child.
That's a proud dad if ever I've heard one.
Oh, mate, takes right after me, that's for sure. So thank you for the question. I'm so over the moon, so grateful. Little Bindi Rose Clift is, oh man, it's just a lot of my world right now.
Well, congratulations, man. And also thank you for the endless tirade of cliches, because I think in certain circumstances, cliches are valid. And it sounds to me like when so many words have already been put to those experiences by humanity, like why try to think of something better to say? Because you know.
Well, there must be something to it if it's a cliche.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And, you know, it makes sense that would be how you feel about your own child. So, yeah, I'm delighted for you. It's, we spoke beforehand and, you know, you were equal parts nervous and excited, right? Which are a very similar feeling. So I'm glad that you have started to find some continuity and some good footing with what is now permanent, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And you know, I just turned 30 the other day too, so I feel like all these kind of tipping points, these initiations have begun in a sense. I mean, 30 is just an arbitrary number, but for me, I'm sure, looking at it as another decade, another epoch, another adventure. And so entering 30 with a baby, recently married, and all these things happening at once, it's been exciting to feel like I'm got my toes over the edge of the threshold as I'm about to enter the hero's journey of this next phase of life. So man, I tell you, it's awesome. I am a diaper ninja. My wife has changed approximately 6 of them. I've changed approximately 600. So I feel like I've got that. I'm getting that down. Then again, we're not at Solid Food yet. I've heard that's pretty traumatic. But, you know, one day at a time.
Yeah. And just from a personal perspective as well, the turning 30, I think there is something for all genders for turning 30, but there's something about the 30, I'm 35 myself, there was something about turning 30, that was when I wrote my book, that was when I had for me it was the real start of the crystallization of the self, you know, that this is who I am now, and this is who I will be as I continue to move forward in my life. And so I think there's something quite special about 30s too. I'm thoroughly enjoyed. Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed most of my 30s, as we'll get onto a bit later. But the sense of self that you have and the groundedness in that is a magical thing. So congratulations on both of those things. You made it to 30.
Thank you.
You have Bindi now. So wonderful.
Yeah. Well, there's something to be said for the 20s, you know, like when I entered my early 20s, I got into the world of business kind of naively and, you know, had some relative success, but I was really struggling with the self, the I part. And I had a mentor kind of just tell me, like, Brandon, you're 23, 24 at the time. He goes, mate, this is not the time to be trying to like set your roots down and try and find stability and security and safety. He's like, you're in your 20s. You need to be rooting, drinking and drugging and just right. living into all these experiences yeah. now. So you don't turn 40, cheat on your wife and buy a Harley. Nothing against right. Harleys, a lot against cheating on your wives. But it is this opportunity sure. to really kind of explore my identity and how it pertains to the rest of the world. So, you know, traveling to South America, getting involved in plant medicine, like living in and around South and Central America, like a lot of travel has been phenomenal in getting to know the man in the mirror. And now I've got Bindi in my life. Now we've got a new house. We've got a new career. We've got all sorts of things happening where I'm going, ooh, I'm really excited now just to grow down, let the roots go deeper. And it's a funny shift. I'm not wanting or needing anything.
Wow.
It's like this really cool contentment.
I was just going to say, it sounds to me like you found contentment.
I found it when I finally got all the tools that I wanted in my workshop, because those will always get my attention. But it does, man. It does. And you know what? I always get itchy for something. In fact, I got itchy for this conversation because, you know, we had you on the show just about a year ago on the 8th of December, 2021. And you came on to talk about how macho culture is damaging for boys and men in greater society. It was a wonderful conversation. We got to hear about your story. And I wanted to invite you back on because it seems like the conversations around men, manhood, masculinity, boys, it's getting quite contentious. It's getting quite muddy. It's getting quite dangerous, it almost feels like. And so I wanted to invite you on because this is a conversation that scares me in a big way because of just how easy it is to go from feeling like an ally for the greater good, feeling like an ally to those who don't feel represented, an ally to those who feel like they, you know, deserve a voice and need a voice, to then get attacked and yeah. to get demonized by those exact people that I'm trying to
yeah.
speak to and support.
Yeah.
being misinterpreted. Yeah. And I know that's something you've experienced recently. I know it's been quite a rite of passage for you. Before we get into that though, I'd love to do a check-in with you. And then we'll get underway. So, I'm happy to kick things off. Brandon, checking in with joy, with fear. Joy and fear. Joy, my dad's in town. With that is a lot of sadness. He flew in from Australia because my aunt passed away. And so there's a lot of healing and grieving happening in the household right now. But grateful to have my father here to be with my baby girl and my wife. It's been absolutely amazing to get to witness my dad with her and get to have him witness me with her as well, which has been really special. And the fear is leaning into this conversation, even though at times it feels like from the purest of intent, it's so easy to get misinterpreted in these conversations. It's so easy to get, or sometimes interpreted correctly and someone disagrees with it, right? And then the chats blow up. So I'm kind of sitting on that skinny branch and both eager, excited and fearful, and I'm in.
Wonderful. Well, I am checking in with a huge amount of fear, if I'm honest, because this is going to be the first time that I've spoken publicly about my experience, but also with a sense of, it's a sense of duty, actually, as somebody who works in this sphere and as somebody who has experienced what I've experienced and has the language and the toolkit to navigate this, I think, I hope, he says. And having done the work on myself to get myself to this point, whilst also having solidified and secured the most fantastic safety net of humans around me, including my new partner, Sina, who is the most fantastic human that I could ever have imagined meeting. And my friends who have been encouraging of me from the very start. And I feel like, I feel a nervous excitement about beginning this conversation and hoping amongst hope that it is heard rather than judged. And that what I want for the conversation at large, and not just about my own experience, is that I am becoming increasingly aware of how men are scared about speaking up on matters such as this because of the fear of the backlash. And I know that when I say that, that women will say, well, women have experienced backlash from men for generations about feminism. I'm like, yes, I'm fully aware of that. Two wrongs don't make a right. And that men are fearful of speaking up because of the potential backlash that they will experience. And also that for men, because of the programming that we've had, I think it's harder for men to speak up on kind of emotional issues such as this. And so, if not me, then who? That is the question I've been asking myself, and is what I said to my mum the other day when she begged me not to do it. I said, if not me, then who? And I said to her, you raised a son who is independently minded and free-spirited and free-thinking. So... So it's your own fault. and she came round, and there's something a very close friend of mine told me, my friend Adele, told me that actually when people have experienced traumatic things in their life, such as what I've experienced, that actually one of the big processing points is when they first feel like they're capable of speaking out about it. Now, I've been speaking about my experience in quote public when I do my work in schools and businesses and whatnot, but this is the first time I've spoken in like wider public. So fearful, but feels like it's necessary for my own development and continuation, because I'm not going to stop doing what I'm doing no matter what anybody ever says about me. So it's time to face the music.
Beautiful, mate. Well, I'm grateful that you feel safe enough, and that you feel that this is a place in space with me that you can have this conversation for the first time.
It's testament to you too, Brandon, you know. It's testament to you and to Boyson and to the work that you're doing that this feels like the right space for me to do that.
Well, I'm grateful. Because, mate, how else can we work through this stuff if we don't talk about it, right? If we don't go there. And, you know, the sad thing is most people aren't... They're neither wanting or willing to have these conversations. And you don't have to be wanting. You can be very unwanting to talk about some of these topics and conversations, but are you willing enough? Are willing enough to perhaps... have a blind spot exposed, bring awareness to an impact that one might be having that they're not even aware of, that they neither intended or unintended, right? So we got to have these conversations, and I'm grateful that you want to have it here. So over the past couple of weeks, we spoke about some things that we could talk about, but I think, why don't we just go there first, if you wouldn't mind... Well, actually, no. Hold off for a second. For those that haven't heard episode 51 of the Mankind podcast, I'd love, if you wouldn't mind, mate, telling us a little bit about yourself, your writings, right, your book, and what kind of brought you into this world. Give us kind of the 30,000 foot view.
Yeah, I'll give you the abridged version because the episode 51 was the full version. In short, my dad died when I was 25. At his funeral, I was delivering a eulogy and I was feeling a sense of pride that I wasn't crying. I was literally feeling a sense of achievement that I was able to contain my emotions in front of all of those people because, quote, it's what my dad would have wanted, right? Three months later, my friends dragged me out of a cocaine and alcohol mess. And the time I was working as a journalist at the BBC, and I thought to myself, how can somebody as privileged as me end up in a place like that? How can somebody who has brought up with all of the familial and emotional privilege that I have, and also having been sent to private school, so supposedly being intelligent, right? How could I have ended up so emotionally illiterate? And I started to look back in my past, and I realized that I was a product of an environment created by men, for men, and by women too, by the whole of society, that had led me to be that way. And so I started to look around, and I found out the suicide statistic in the UK about the biggest killer of men being suicide for people under the age of 45. And this was 10 years ago when it wasn't really very well known. Like now it's, you know, every audience I speak to, I ask them and they all shout suicide to me in unison. Like they all know the statistic. But for me, it blew my tiny brains out because that's a terrible choice of terminology to use given what I'm talking about. Let's retract that. For me, it blew my mind.
Oh, how human of you, Chris. How human of you to say not the best fitting word in the middle
really
of the topic.
That's really not a bad choice of words, yeah. It blew my mind, right? And I almost couldn't believe it. So then I started to look around and I just started to research and I just started to tell stories and I started to write about my own experience and I started to understand myself a lot more, but also to understand more and more this construct that we as men have been placed into against our will, right? And how very, very damaging some, not all, of it can be. So I started writing about it. I wrote a book that came out in 2017 called Be a Man. I'm now a psychotherapist. I work solely with men and boys. I run a program in schools and businesses where it's kind of focused on the idea of empathy and compassion. And I do a variety of workshops and talks and pastoral care. And yeah, it's my life's work now. It's to the point where I actually now have to put boundaries in place when I'm on nights out or socializing, when people ask me about my work, because I'm like, I think about this stuff all the time. I can't stop, right? People have tried to stop me, and that's what we're going to get onto, but I cannot and will not stop doing the work that I'm doing because, well, two reasons. One, I'm doing it for 15-year-old Chris, and always will be, but mostly I'm doing it for the boys who speak to me and tell me how important it is that somebody like me came and spoke to them honestly and gave them the chance to be seen and heard. And that's what most boys need. And actually, I think that's what's not, that isn't happening enough right now. So yeah, I love this work. It has its pitfalls, right? We stick our head above the parapet and we get pelted and we get shot at. And sometimes, like happened with me, I get snipered and people try to take me down and people try to take men down for speaking about stuff. And as we're going to get onto, I hope, this idea that in Western cultures right now, actually, there is far too little targeted support for men and boys. And when someone does say, well, what about men? They say, well, the whole world is set up for men. And I'm sorry, that just doesn't cut it anymore. That's just not true. So yeah, that for me is this next phase of my work, is partly drawn upon my recent experience, but mainly drawn upon the conversations I've had with boys for the past 5 years in schools and in businesses with young men who want help, don't know how to ask for it, don't know how to do it for each other, and when they do try and when they do speak up on their own behalf, are too often shot down. So, yeah, that's
from what seems like all angles now.
It's what, sorry?
Oh, people, it seems like it's coming from all angles now for teens and young men to speak up. Previously, it was, you know, don't be a pussy. Don't be a sissy. Don't be a girl. That's the most common narrative. We've had that forever. Like, that's come from a long history of engendered expectations of men. But now it's, I'm a man and I have these struggles. We're not only getting that previous message, probably just as much as we have previously from one group of people, we're also now getting, well, who are you to be upset, depressed? You're privileged. You may happen to be white, straight, silver spoon, sure, but you're not allowed to feel bad. You're not allowed to have challenges or struggles because you're not non-male.
Yeah.
Not straight. So now I'm witnessing in some of the men and boys that I'm working with is that they're like, it seems even a little bit more tricky to come out and speak about the challenges they're facing or advocate for the needs that they have.
Yeah.
It's almost like we can't have this conversation without presumption and name calling and without assumptions that if I'm going to talk about the issues facing boys and men, then I am inherently anti women, right? Anti LGBTQI people, right? Yeah. If I'm going to speak about the challenges facing boys and men.
Yeah, and this is a conversation, you know, I have so many anecdotes that I want to tell during the course of this, and I like the fact that we have long time for it. I was recently speaking with a group of men from one of the, in the UK, what we call one of the big four accountancy firms, right, that I've done some work in. These men came to an event that I was doing, and they spoke to me afterwards, and the you know, my thing in businesses now, I'm talking to a few businesses about actually starting up a men's network, right? Because I say, does your business have a women's network, an LGBTQ network, a race and ethnicity, a disability network? Yeah, fantastic. That is wonderful that you have all of those. Do you have a men's network? Well, no. And I, well, why not? And sometimes you get the flippant, well, the whole world is a men's network. And it's like, but I mean, you're literally female and you're in this room. So that's not true. Like, I'm not saying that there needs to be a network at this business to help men become the CEO, because all of the men sat around the boardroom table are male, right? Or mostly, although that's changing too. But then I say, well, what can we do about that, right? And it's like, well, why do the men need this space? And I say, do I need to list all of the statistics that are so well known? Do you need me to tell you the suicide stats, the addiction statistics, the loneliness statistics, the fact that every single age group between 0 and 100, men in the UK report lower life satisfaction than women? That actually the role of men has changed so dramatically in the past 40, 50 years that men don't know what to do with themselves? Do I have to actually say this to you? Or can we just accept that we can hold both thoughts in our head at the same time? That we can do that, right? That we can do the help for everybody and men too, right? And so that's the pushback that I get. But what was really, really sad, and this is where I think the biggest problem is these men said, this guy said to me, and I quote, I feel like if I was to set up a men's network in my business, I would be taking up the space that other networks have. And I said to him, brother, unless you and the boys are barging in to the women's network meeting, you are not taking up their space. You are just creating new space. But the problem is, and this is where I'm coming in now, is actually, as men, we haven't done this before. So we don't have the toolkit, right? We aren't raised to be empathetic and compassionate and socially justice orientated. So we don't know how to start these processes. And this is the big problem, right? Is we are beginning to recognize that as men, we are experiencing issues. But actually, as men, we are amateurs at even beginning to have the conversation. Because if one man speaks up and says, oh, I think that we should have this thing because there's problems, actually what also happens is a load of guys still will call him a pussy, will say that he's weak, will pretend like they're all fine. And a few years ago, I was at a conference for teachers, and there was a young lad sitting in the audience, and I said, and he put his hand up at the end of my speech, and he said, why is there no men's network in this union? And I said, fantastic question. Have you tried to start one? And he said, no. And I said, okay. To the women in the audience, how many of you have been fundamental in the founding of some sort of group within this union? And like a quarter of the audience put their hands up, of the women in the audience. And then I said, okay, lads. So those of you in the audience who are male right now, how many of you would like to be founding part of a men's network in this union? And maybe six hands went up, I think. And I was like, right, you only need three for a group. So you've got six. I was like, stay behind. I'll give you my time. We'll talk about it. The Q&A finished. The conference was over. And the lad who asked the question was just left sick. He was left sitting there on his own. Yeah, that's what you're going to say, right?
Shocker.
He was just left sitting on his own. And I went up to him and I gave him a hug and I was like, that's the problem, man. Is that actually we want these spaces, but actually we don't know how to do it. Or we want it done for us because for so much of our life, women have done these things for us. And that's why it's time.
They have.
That's why it's time for us to start doing this for each other and for ourselves, actually. That's what I say to young boys is actually be selfish about it. Do this for yourself first. Do this work for yourself first. Because this is about you and it always has been about you.
Man, I feel like a broken record when I say what I'm about to say, but it just always comes up for me in just about every conversation I have is that life and this world is not a zero-sum game.
No.
For there to be a men's support network in an organization, in a city, in a town, in a country, does not mean that something is being taken away from any other group.
No.
In fact, it adds to the benefit, right? It supports. I mean, that's one thing my men's groups does is we go, okay, what parades are happening? What nonprofits are doing a drive this weekend? Like, we chat about it. How can we support? How can we get together? And then we hold each other accountable to our blind spots, right? We support one another in identifying our perhaps some of our biases that we don't know are running the bus, driving the bus right now.
Yeah.
And it's saddening. You did a post the other day about the phrase toxic masculinity, how the phrase in itself has become toxic. I agree with you in that. In fact, it's been so broadened in its use recently that it kind of broad strokes, it's kind of like a large term representing any behavior of boys and men that people deem or that people don't like.
Yeah.
Regardless of the behavior falling under the column of masculine, as a masculine characteristic, or even a feminine characteristic, the fact that a man or boy behaved in that way, it's boom, toxic masculinity. Whereas like in 2016, only a very small group of scholars were using it.
Yeah.
So I'd like to talk about how we've gotten here, but also what what you were trying to illuminate and elucidate in that when you were talking about it, because I saw the comments after that they were pretty juicy.
Yeah. The thing is, though, I you know, a friend of mine who was the one who's encouraged me back onto social media, Annie, she was like, oh, you know, she's like, the comments, they're so mean. And I was like, but I have no problem with people disagreeing with me. Like, mm-hmm. for as long as I've been doing the work that I do, I've had people disagree with me online. When I used to write for a newspaper in the UK, there was a guy whose moniker was Brutus, and under every single article I ever wrote for The Independent, he made some snarky comment about me, calling me all sorts of names. And like, I used to laugh with my mates and think, like, I swear this is one of you boys. Like, I know, like, this can't be a real guy. So for me, the kind of the online trolling and the disagreement, like, I don't mind people disagreeing with me. Actually, one of the people who I would say the juicy comment that you talk about, I actually messaged her privately and had a conversation with her and I are going to have a conversation at some point, because it was like, wow, we disagree with each other excellently. I think we should have a conversation. And it's like,
yeah.
That sort of stuff for me is fantastic. But it's good. When, yeah. And I this feels like a good time to pivot into what my experience was online, actually, because is that okay? Is it okay if I dive into that now? Because
let's jump in.
Yeah, this for me was why I wanted to speak with you today, really. Not just this, but it's difficult for me to talk about this because there's a lot that I want to say, right? And the stuff that I can't say because I don't want to drag individuals down. And I also don't want to paint myself as a victim, right? Because I think that's part of the problem, is victimhood culture and what I call, like, living in a kind of world of, like, a trauma contest that we seem to live in at the moment. And so I don't want to paint myself in it. Yeah, it's again, the zero-sum game. Like, individual experiences are individual experiences. But what I want to start with, actually, is I read an article in the Times in the UK a couple of days ago by a woman called Hadley Freeman. And I just want to read a quote from it before I explain my own situation, right? And I kind of wanted to bookend it with this, because I'm going to read it at the start and then I'm going to tell my story and then I'm going to read it again at the end. And I just want people to think about my experience and what Hadley Freeman says. And she's a outspoken feminist woman in the UK, right? She said, this was an article about why feminism has become a dirty word, right? She said, so much of fourth wave feminism was based on individual women's experiences rather than collective change. On the plus side, this led to Me Too. On the downside, it led to women seeing validation of their experience as their feminist right. This was epitomized by the mantra, quote, believe women, which was well-intended but utterly unworkable. If a society believes in due process and doesn't think anyone should be damned as a sex offender on the basis of allegation and rumour. Interesting that I read this in the days leading up to this conversation, right? Because what happened with me was this. About 18 months ago, more, nearly 2 years ago now, a woman in the UK was murdered by a police officer. So she was called Sarah Everard. It made international headlines. It was all anyone was talking about in the UK for weeks. And at the time, I was a BBC journalist, and I was a freelance journalist. So I speak on this area, and I went on air as a commentator rather than as a BBC journalist. And when I went into work that day, the strap line said women's safety concerns or something like that. And what I did was talk to the producer about the kind of Jackson Katz narrative. If you don't know about Jackson Katz, you should. The Jackson Katz thing about the passive voice. And I said that what we're doing here is we're talking about women's safety, but we're not actually talking, where is the word men? So I had this whole thing, right? And I clipped the video and it went, well, so I clipped the video first, I posted it, And then the BBC said, because of editorial issues, because I worked for the BBC, that I had to take it down. So I took it down for about 6 hours. And then I remembered something that I've said to boys and men ever since I've started doing this work, that sometimes you have to speak up for what is right, no matter the impact it has on you. So I tell young boys, when you hear homophobia, transphobia, misogyny, racism, when you see violence, like, who's going to be the brave one to speak up at that time, even if you get called all of those names that we know, right? And so I thought to myself, I'm being a hypocrite here. So I reposted it. And as a result of that, I lost my work at the BBC. And I've never been back into the BBC building since, right? So the video went crazy viral. It had, like, literally millions of views. And I was getting, you know, I'll be honest, I was getting all of the self-esteem boosting pride that finally I was getting some, like, hardcore recognition, and people were desperate for me to go and speak on the, you know, I was getting booked for all of these news outlets and speaking, and people wanted me to speak everywhere. And, like,
I saw you on Trevor Noah.
Exactly.
That was my first introduction. I was like, all right.
It went crazy, right? But then what happened was, and this, I can only speak how I experienced it at the time, was that at the time there was fervent man-hatred happening in the UK because of what this police officer had done, right? You know, man in power, sure. you know, it was horrible what this man did, right? And slowly but surely there started to be a trickle of women who had a beef with me. So it started with a woman who is a high-level news presenter in the UK saying that basically I needed to shut up and listen to women right now, because once in a studio I told her that I was in charge of her, right? Now, this is something that I actually said I was in charge of the output when I was the producer and she'd not done the thing that I'd asked of her, and we had a conversation afterwards and I apologized and that was it, and we worked together for like a year or so afterwards. But anyway, this was, you know, that was the first thing that happened. Then a woman who I'd gone to university with posted about an occasion where I'd sexually harassed her at a party. And I did sexually harass her at a party. It was like 5 years ago now. And what I did was I made a comment, a sexualized comment about her body that wasn't okay. When she called me out for it, I responded badly. I obfuscated. I didn't actually remember doing it because it was a throwaway comment. Obviously not as impactful on me as it was for her, of course. So I didn't remember it. But once I did remember it, I apologized to her. And I thought that was that. So then she reposted it, like she brought this argument back up again 4 years later online. So I apologized again publicly, and I put a screenshot on Twitter of the opening chapter of my book, where I used this incident as an example, without naming her or anything, as an example of where I needed to do better. And a lot of people were like, well, okay, fair enough, right? But then what happened was a woman that I dated briefly a couple of years ago made a false allegation of sexual abuse against me. Now, what she actually said, and I'm not going to go into the details, but the thing that she said online, two things. First of all, is not true. But second of all, even the thing that she did say is not sexual abuse. But the problem was, is that she used the term sexual abuse about me. And from there, I just reaped the fucking whirlwind. And I was denounced as a sexual predator, as a monster, as a danger to women. And actually, the allegation was retracted. But that doesn't matter, right?
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. That's not how. And I lost. It felt at the time I lost everything. I was absolutely devastated, because my thing has always been, and anybody who knows me and anybody who has ever engaged with my work knows that I have always taken responsibility, ever since I've started doing this work, right? And actually the thing that happened with the woman with the sexual harassment, that was the final straw for me, right? And after that, I had huge thought, which is why I put it in my book, right? I was never going to engage with somebody again, but not like just completely discounting their experience of me. But the problem was, is that I was being told that I had to take responsibility for something that I simply hadn't done. And all that was being said was believe women, believe women, believe women, you know. And then I had journalists, people that I'd worked with for years, messaging this, tweeting at this woman saying, I believe you. And you're like, what? You're a journalist and you haven't actually... Because what happened was, the BBC, the woman at the BBC that I was speaking to, who was really kind, to be fair, she was like, well, this story is now going to get picked up by papers, right? But the thing is, I had journalists speak to me. Some very, very high up female journalists in the UK spoke to me. And when people actually took the time to listen to my side of things, what they found out was I was not in denial that I had caused this woman pain, right? I know for certain that I caused this woman pain. And I'm not going to get into the details of how, but let's just say I could have been a lot more kinder and compassionate, right? This woman, though, also caused me pain during the relationship. So, like, you know, But I didn't sexually abuse anyone, and I have never sexually abused anyone. But what happened to me, Brandon, was that I fell into the darkest pit of despair that I could ever imagine myself being in. And I went to a place where I contemplated suicide. For a very brief period of my life, I didn't want to be alive anymore. Because I thought that that was it, right? I thought that I would never, ever, ever get to do this work ever again. I thought that I had lost, you know, I thought that everybody would disavow me, because that's the world we live in now. And it was fucking brutal. And I had some people say some stuff to me during that time that honestly I can't believe. Like, for example, it's not as bad as being raped, as if that matters. Like, I had people saying to me that they thought that it was pathetic, you know, women saying to me that they thought that it was pathetic that I was feeling suicidal. That women who went to university with me and had experienced me when I was at my awful, laddish worst, saying to me how hard it was for them to see me being accused of these things. And I'm being like, as a man, I'm not allowed to have feelings here. That my feelings are irrelevant, because because all of the attention has to be put upon the real victim, who is this woman who I didn't sexually abuse, but sure, I caused pain because it was a failed relationship, right? And I kind of want to skip ahead to how I'm feeling right now and then go back, because how I'm feeling right now is this. The reason why I want to speak about this is this, right? Because in the immediate aftermath of that video of mine going viral, I had hundreds, if not thousands, no, that's an exaggeration, hundreds of men reach out to me privately to say, thank you for articulating something that I have thought but didn't know how to say. Hundreds of women saying, thank you as a man for speaking up. And then suddenly after the allegation was made, I had people saying, oh, let's not listen to this guy. Let's no longer listen to this man. And I saw the almost gleeful, like women gleefully saying, you see, no man can be trusted. Like some prominent feminist women were tweeting about it. And it like, it seemed like they were almost happy that I was like proving something, right? And so I had so many men speak to me. And I spoke to a really close friend of mine the other day, who's a guy who I have these conversations with sporadically. And he said, he was one of the first ones who reached out to me and said, you keep telling men to speak up. I'm not going to speak up. Why would I speak up? Why would I speak up? Why would I stick my head above the parapet? Because every single man has crossed a sexual boundary at some point. Every single woman has as well, but Christ, let's not get into that, right? Every human has caused pain, right? And I had men of this cricket team that I'm a part of who were absolutely sensational. These older guys were so sensational. So many of them saying, the phrase, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. Like, you know, this could have been any of us, right? And so my thing is, the reason I'm speaking up today and telling my side of things, and I'm ready for you to challenge me, Brandon. I want you to, like, because this needs to be challenged. I need to be challenged on this. But my thing is, we as a society are desperately asking men to speak up on these issues. Suddenly a man speaks up at a time when it's really, really appropriate for a man to speak up, and women are either saying, shut up and listen to women, or they're saying, this man's not perfect, so don't listen to a word he's saying. And then what happened to me subsequently was, the woman who rightly accused me of sexual harassment, she began to cyberstalk and harass me and anybody who dared to speak about still working with me, to the point where I had to call the police on her twice. But I haven't gone public with that until now. I didn't shame her for that publicly online. But I see her speaking on anti-harassment panels because she's spoken up. And yet she's harassed me actively to the point where I've had to call the police on her twice. But you know what the saddest thing of all about the whole thing for me was? Is that all of the 10 of us men in the UK that do this work publicly, a large proportion of those men jumped on the bandwagon and joined in the cancellation of me. And these are guys who profess to do men's work. And that for me was the saddest thing of all. Was that these guys were so ready to just kick me out of their community. And like the other day, there was a masculinity conference and somebody retweeted it. And I looked at the thing and they'd blocked me before I'd even known about it. I've been kicked out of the community in the UK. Nobody wants to engage with me anymore. And all because I was falsely accused of sexual abuse. And I've recovered now, as much as I'll ever recover from it. It'll always stay with me. I have anxiety that I've never had before to the extent that I have now. It has changed who I am as a person. And I will say this, and I know you can't see me, but I have a smile on my face when I say this, and I told my therapist the same thing. It's like, I hate the fact that it's true, but it's the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I went to the depths of my soul and back, and I liked what I saw. And no one can ever take that away from me.
Went to the depths of the darkness, depths of your soul, and you love what you saw. Thank you for sharing your experience. You know yourself better than anyone. Where I'll first start to challenge you is that you said you have, these are my words, but the extent in which you've been able, that you could heal from the experience, that you've reached that. Am I representing your words correctly?
I guess I don't know, right? Because, I'm sure there's more healing to happen. But I'm as healed as I can be right now, to the point where,
sure,
I didn't have an anxiety attack before this conversation, right? So, yeah. Wow. Okay. I mean, in that period, I've also continued my training, and I'm nearly qualified as a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. So my word, that has helped. That whole process has really helped. But I didn't quit, which I wanted to at one point. So, yeah.
Well, I'm grateful you didn't. I'm really grateful you didn't. There's a lot there. And I have, I have to check myself right. I have to check myself right now, because I'm feeling so much from what you shared. I can feel myself getting pulled into a narrative that isn't going to be helpful to this conversation, your situation, or this greater, or the greater work, right?
Can I ask what that is? I'm interested to know what that is. We don't have to go into it, but I'm interested to know what that path is that you don't want to go down.
It's for sure. It's anger. It's anger that how many gigs at schools didn't come to pass because of what you what happened, right?
Oh, countless.
How many? Countless. How many boys needed to hear your message that didn't? How, and these are all what ifs, right? But what's so saddening for me is that in this space, what would you call this space? It's in this higher awareness, transformational world that many like to proclaim they exist, where so many people and so many powers could be doing phenomenal work together for the greater good, it is instead insidious. It is instead a battleground internally, where you could go on television, share words that are non-contentious nor confrontational, and someone's narrative, not discrediting the narrative in a sense of their reality, right?
Yeah.
Could impact so much good that could be done, is what's truly saddening for me. However, here we are, December 2022, all right?
Yeah.
And you checked in with what it's been like to come through the other side of that gauntlet. And would you say that's the deepest work you've done to date?
I can't imagine ever having to go any deeper, because there was a point in my life where I sat and I said, Am I a sexual abuser? And I did a lot of inquiry about myself, and I actually spoke with a lot of women in my life who I've been in that sort of space with, and I know that individual experiences are unique and different, but so many of those women said, oh, at times you were an absolute dickhead in our relationship, and like, yeah, I could have told you that. But actually in the sexual realm, many said that I was the safest man they'd ever experienced in that space. So like, I have my own understanding and thoughts about why somebody would say those things about me. I'm not going to get into them now. That's between her and I, right? But actually, I know that that's not me. But do you want to know what actually made me start doing the work again? About 2 weeks after this happened, I got an email from a young lad, and it was very, very long email. Now, this was a lad who I'd spoken to about 2 years previously in a school, and I can't find the full email right now, but a quote of his is on my website, and the quote is this. Hearing you speak was a hugely formative experience, and one that I will likely never forget about. I've now grown to a place where I feel I have the tools to work on myself independently and think about these issues with a clarity I do not know if otherwise I would have found. And this email that this boy wrote to me, well, this man now wrote to me, was the moment where I was like, there was two moments, right? There was this, where I was like, fuck, I can't stop doing this. Because you know what, Brandon? Mm. You know what the saddest thing for me was? I wasn't just trying to help. I was and am literally helping.
Mm-hmm.
And I have countless testimonials from boys and schools and parents about the impact my work has. And the people who I'm actually trying to help, a small minority try to drag me down, right? And so I will not stop.
That's the people kicker, can say whatever, right?
Yeah.
Such a small majority.
Yeah. And
that small majority, has the ability. Yeah. Sorry, a small minority. Words.
Yeah.
Baby brain.
And so there was
but there was such a small portion.
So there was that, but there's also a story that I very quickly that I want to tell. Like, on what was, I think, the darkest day of my entire life, I had a dream. And in the dream, I was sitting in the car on the back seat in the middle, because I'm the youngest of three brothers, right? So that was my domain. And it was all, I was on my own and my dad was driving. And we were driving past a place called Garden Street in Manchester. And Garden Street was the place where my dad always said it was the best game of football he'd ever seen me play. And my dad died 10 years ago, as I said, right? In this dream, my dad turned around and he looked me dead. And I've never dreamt about my dad before or after. My dad looked me square in the eyes and said, son, you can only kill yourself once. And I woke up and I was like, fucking hell. And that was it. I was like, well, my dad has just told me I'm not allowed to kill myself. So I can't. And from that day on, what I decided was, what he was actually telling me was, it's not all bad, this masculinity stuff, right? That we can be fucking brave and tough and strong sometimes when we need to be.
Mm.
So that's what I did. From that day on, I started to get better. And I started to fight for myself to come back. And we're not together anymore, because what happened to me just destroyed our relationship. But my ex at the time, I can't say with any certainty that I would be alive today if it wasn't for her. We don't speak anymore for reasons, but I had such a great support network around me. And I had so many people in my life just telling me, you have to get back to do the work. You have to get back to do the work. And so I started to speak to some schools and I started to tell them what had happened. And what I found really quickly was these schools were like, okay, some people said some shit about you online. If we stopped working with people based on that, then we'd be absolute hypocrites because we tell our children not to believe what you read on social media. To understand that there's two sides to every story. And so some schools, not all, did start to book me again, did start to work with me again. And slowly but surely I've refound, like, you know, I lament the fact that I could have had a huge platform to do this work. I had people wanting to make documentaries with me. They wanted to feature me on like The One Show and the BBC, which is like one of the biggest programs in the country. And, you know, the amount of reach I could have had makes me sad, right? But I've had this formative experience now. And you know what? The amount of empathy I have for young boys has increased infinite because Boys now say to me, yeah, exactly. I've been to the dark depths as a result of daring to speak up. And now I can't ever say to them that there'll be no consequences for speaking up. And actually what I say now is, it'll probably be the hardest thing that you ever do. But in the end, we're doing it for the right reason. And I do this work because I believe in it. And I do this work because I know that every time I step into a school, at least one boy that I speak to that day will leave that day going, I can be who I want to be and not who is expected of me. And I can be better. And so if people who are listening to this are determined to stop me, they're not going to. Because if you stop me working in school, I'll go down the pub and speak to the old guy at the bar and I'll still do the work. So yeah, now I'm a psychotherapist working solely with men, unapologetically working solely with men, and will continue to do so until I can no longer do that for whatever reason. And now my next thing is I'm going to train up a couple of people to do my work in schools so that more schools can get covered. And I'm hoping to grow the business side of things so that I can continue to have the impact that I've been having. And I say that with no ego. I say that just with a knowledge of young boys coming up to me at the end of a day and saying, you've changed my worldview. Thank you. That's it for me, Brandon.
Thank you. So what if this...
That was hard.
So what if this all in itself has transpired for this next version of you? Because I hear you talk about the documentaries and what could have been. Who cares what could have been, Chris? Look where you've gone, right? Look where you're going. This is to have that greater empathy and awareness and experience to be able to meet boys and men now whom you may have never been able to tap into if it weren't for this experience. When we talk a lot about ripples on this show and in the Mankind Project, and you know, you say you speak to a room full of hundreds of kids, and one boy, if it's one boy whose worldview changes because of your work, mate, that's immeasurable. It's immeasurable, that impact. So I'm more excited for this edition of Chris Hemmings than I would have ever been for the last one. Your movie's far more exciting than it's ever been.
that's the reality for me, and that's why I'm here, and that's why I'll continue, because actually, you know, there's a saying, Carl Rogers said, you can only, you know, with therapy clients, you can only take your clients as far as you've been yourself. Well, I've been fucking far now, man. Like, my work with men that I sit in front of now is so much richer as a result. You know, my therapist was incredible and really, really helped to hold the space for me to be furiously angry, to be terrified, to cry and scream, and to be confused, and just it's such an important experience for me. But actually, it's almost like I needed to be truly, truly broken apart so that I could see which the fact, I'd spent years trying to unpick my own behaviors, right? And trying to understand why I behaved in certain ways and the impact that had. But really what happened is now I feel like I'm at a place now where I'm the true authentic version of myself, because what else do I have to be scared of now, right? Nothing is as terrifying as that will ever be. So
there you go.
Well,
there
you fuck, go. Fingers crossed.
fingers, you know, yeah, until the, you know what? Go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, I lost my dad at 25, and that was really, really rough. But death and grief are things that are expected. You know, a year or so later, I lost my best friend, one of my best friends, Charlie, died. And that was really, really rough. The breakup with my partner in between those two things, Zoe, was really, really rough. This experience that I had was like nothing I would wish on my worst enemies. Many people ask me why I didn't require that the retraction was done publicly, and I was like, I don't want her to experience a single ounce of what I've experienced online, because it was so brutal, man.
It wouldn't help things that you believe in and want to support too, right?
No.
How about taking another step? Now, this one takes some courage, and you have it. Come check out the Men's Work Introduction. It's 3 sessions over 3 weeks. Go to themenswork.org.
No. You know, I believe, what I judge of you, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, is you believe that women should speak up when they have been victims of such things.
Yes.
And when it is, when that is misused, it harms everything.
It does.
That goes towards and healing, right?
Yeah. And I actually want to reread the thing that I read before, because I think it really makes sense. So I'll read this thing from Hadley Freeman, right? It led to women seeing validation of their experiences as their feminist right, epitomized by the mantra "believe women," which was well-intended but utterly unworkable. If a society believes in due process and doesn't think anyone should be damned as a sex offender on the basis of allegation and rumor, and that's it, right? That's the problem for me with all of this, is that what happens is, one woman says something, and from then on, that man is just completely and utterly condemned in the court of social media, right? And that's what I experienced. I was given, there was no recourse for me. There's no way back in, right? Nobody gives a shit what I have to say, because all I'll say is that I deny it, right? Whereas actually, so for those who aren't aware, there's a thing in Gestalt therapy called the drama triangle, right? And in the drama triangle, you have the savior at one point, and then you have victim and perpetrator in the other. Now, the first anxiety attack that I had ever in my life, I was sat in a lecture at university learning about the drama triangle. And my lecturer said, what happens is often people get stuck between victim and perpetrator, because what they say is, I was hurt by you, right? Because you are X, Y, and Z, an abusive perpetrator, rapist, you know, horrible man, whatever, right? And so then what happens is victim and perpetrator switch. So you suddenly become the perpetrator. Now, I am not saying that there are not important conversations to have. I actually think that between me and all of these women who said things about me, that there are not important conversations to have that I would have engaged in with good faith if there was the opportunity to. But what happened was, I thought about the woman who ended up harassing me to the point where I had to get the police involved. I started to empathize with her, to think that she is trapped in this drama triangle where she can't she can't escape it, right? Because she believes that she's so much the victim that she becomes the perpetrator. And I said to my lecturer, I put my hand up and I said, how does somebody escape from this? And she says, the people around them have to point out that that's what's happening. And I had an anxiety attack because I finally felt empathy for this person who I actually have very little negative feeling towards the woman who falsely accused me. I have my understanding of why she did. For this other woman, I couldn't understand it. And finally, the penny dropped. And I had an anxiety attack. And I had to leave. And I had to I had to go outside and like actually call my friends and cry and scream and shout. Like, that I understand now what's happening. And too much of this, and this is what goes back to what we were talking about at the very start, that when men speak up, or men are fearful of speaking up, because when they do, they get called names, they get told that they are horrible, that they are perpetrators. And so actually what it does, it induces shame and it pushes us further and further away from conversation. And I had an experience, one of the first schools actually I ever went into after this happened. I sat down and the teacher warned me that the girls had heard about what had happened and were coming in to challenge me. And I was like, okay, I'm okay to be challenged. That's fine. But first I sat down with all the lads in the school, in this year group. And the lads told me that the girls in the school had a cancellation list of all of the boys that they deemed to have crossed a line, right? And that some of the boys said that they were on this list because they had spoken up in their own defense or in the defense of men and had disagreed with some of the women's, the girls' feminist diktat, is kind of how they described it. Mm-hmm. And so the girls had, quote, cancelled them. And when I spoke to the girls about it, I said, why do you have this list? Like, what do you think this list is achieving? And the girls said to me, well, if the boys are on this list, they're going to want to change their behavior and they're going to want to get off it. And I was just like, no. By putting the boys on that list, you push them further and further away from engaging in conversations that actually most of them would like to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And that
it doesn't entice them to support what the girls want, nor does it engage them to look at their behavior in a clean way.
No. And too much of where we're at now is the binary, that I am right and you are wrong, and there's no space for nuance.
Yeah, no space for nuance. And the fact that you are wrong means I have a right to treat you in any which way that I seem fit.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what scares me. With what we're seeing a lot right now, an inability to have conversation, an inability to work together. So easy to put someone on a list. Shit, we have some scary examples throughout history of what that looks like.
Yeah.
And it that's what really, as someone who's used the phrase toxic masculinity to explain the behaviors of boys and men, which I don't deem helpful, which I don't deem healthy. Number one, I have been a perpetrator of all those things that I judged others in using that phrase. And number two, the phrase in itself, I jump to this now because of what we're talking about, of just how easy it is to broadstroke someone on that and put them on that list as a toxic male. And we can dive into the difference, but that, you know, masculinity is not something that is reserved for just men. They are objective characteristics that are commonly displayed by men.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But if we look at the, you know, the toxic masculinity is in the online dictionary. It says a cultural concept of manliness that glorifies stoicism, strength, virility, and dominance, and that is socially maladaptive or harmful to mental health. So let me ask you, Chris, out of stoicism, strength, virility, and dominance, Is there one word that stands out to you as something that may not be helpful? All of them.
For me, the I do a seminar with kind of 16 to 18 year olds on masculinity, right? And I do a thing where I say to them, I don't use this term, right? But if I was to ask you, what are the traits that are associated with toxic masculinity, right? And you know what? I took a photo of it the other day. So let me read out the list. So violence, no emotions, being sexist, having to be a stud, being overprotective, being possessive, being controlling, being manipulative, being aggressive. And there are many lists, and not all groups give me the same answer, right?
Sure.
And I say to them, if we break each and every one of those down to its core, what is it actually about? And I have yet to have an answer from the years of doing this where it isn't about dominance.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of those that I read out is about somehow men either being or being perceived to be superior and dominant. So for me, really, it is about dominant, the dominance narrative. That's what it is for me, right? And I've done this, and you know, so much. But every man has played into this. Women have played into this too. Like the desire to constantly prove our dominance is what causes a lot of, if not all, of these problems. And I say to men, if I was to wave a magic wand. Right, it's called the miracle question in psychotherapy. If I was to wave a magic wand and I was just to remove the desire to be dominant every single day, how would it feel? How would you feel? And they go, I would be free, I would be relieved, I would be liberated. Safe, I could be myself. And it's like, right.
Yes.
So for me, it's the dominance thing that's the biggest problem.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So we look at stoicism, strength, virility. So all of that, I guess, is the baby with the bathwater and every other definition that we have of what is considered to be toxic masculinity just gets thrown out thrown into the mix. And so what that's that broad stroking that doesn't allow for the nuance, it doesn't allow for the conversation. And so I think that what you just said then now relates to the importance of having these groups for boys and men, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's like just my men's group that I host in my garage each week, to be able to have those conversations of, okay, how has what you were describing before sounds very similar to the man box, right? Paul Kimball's work on identifying, right, all these behaviors in the playground that you had to abide by if you wanted to be a man, be a boy, right?
Yeah.
To fit the mold. And more in these circles, in these spaces, men are able to take those off and identify in taking off that armor, taking off those expectations of how to behave as a man or a boy, that they then, and having a space in which they can practice speaking, right? Practice speaking to these things. Because you know what? Sometimes my intention is to say this, but my words represent something that can easily be, taken and skewed any which way. They get that space to practice and identify like, oh, it's a sandbox. Who am I as a man? Because if I want to be an ally for Me Too, if I want to be an ally for feminists, if I want to be an ally to my LGBTQ brothers, and beyond, of course, not just brothers, then I need to be able to do my work. But if you're telling me that my work is not important just because I happen to be male and straight and white, and that it's not important for me to do that, then where can we go from here? Where can men go from there?
Yeah. But this goes back to what I said at the very start as well, because what I say now to audiences is this, that when you were born, and I do a men's mental health workshop, right, and this is a big part of that. You have to think of it this way: when you were born, did you tick a box that said that you opt into this framework, right? Did any of us choose this? Did you choose to be forced to abide by all of these things, or some of these things? And obviously not all men abide by all of them, and it's on a spectrum, of course, for each of us, right? Well, no, of course you didn't, right? Sure. So what I'm actually offering you today is the option to opt out. And I'm under no illusion that for many of you, opting out will be one of the most difficult things you will ever experience in your entire life. I'm 10 years into the process of opting out. It's going to take the rest of my life, and I still won't make it all the way. But the sooner you start to opt out, the easier it will be for you, right? And what I say to young boys in particular is what I'm asking of you today is, I'm not asking you to change who you are. What I am offering you is the chance to be who you really are underneath all of the bravado and the pretense and the posturing and the dominance loop and all of that stuff. Yeah. Who are you really? Mm. And I speak about personal experience, and I speak about, you know, I have conversations with many men, and this is what I say to my audiences, right? I have conversations with men all the time. This is the work that I do. And I have met a lot of men who have chosen to opt out, and they have hated the process. They have been kicking and screaming. Yeah. They have made mistakes. They have hurt themselves and other people along the way. But you know what? I am yet to meet a man who has chosen to opt out who regrets it.
Who regrets it? Yeah.
And recently I was at a party and I met Steve, and I'm going to big up Steve right now, because Steve spent 12 years as an addict, and he just completed 3 months of rehab. And we were outside and I said to him, congratulations, man, that's incredible. How do you feel now? And he said, you know what, Chris? I now realize about 40% of my personality had remained hidden my entire life because of all this pretense. And I said to him, well, how does it feel now, man? And he said, you know what? It feels beautiful. Life is so much more beautiful. And that's what's being offered, right, Brandon? But I feel like we've skipped a few steps, because the problem is, for me, and this, I guess, is the next bit of the work and the conversation that I'd like to have with you now, is where is the space for the growth and development of boys and men when we are constantly being told that male-only spaces are toxic, when we are constantly being told that men don't need support and care because the whole world is set up for men to succeed? Well, actually, we know that that's not true. If the whole world is set up for men to succeed, why did 3 times as many men kill themselves? Why did 3 times as many men have an alcohol and drug addiction? Why is it that actually I'm far more likely to be the victim of violence walking down a street than any woman will be? The statistics prove that. And I'm not saying that we should discount, you know, what I say is, if there's an epidemic of male violence against women, there's a pandemic of male violence against men. But we as men are not doing the work to combat it. So where is the space for those conversations? And that's where my work is going now, is to challenge men and say, all right, guys, many of you are starting to realize that the world is not great for men. So what are we going to do about it as men? And what I talk about is the analogy of the oxygen mask on a plane. When you're sitting on a plane and they talk about the oxygen mask falling down, they say to you, put your own oxygen mask on first before you help anyone else. And for me, that's the step that has been missed here. We are telling young boys that they have to start being better for women and girls and queer people and whatever. But actually, for me, it starts, and this is where my work starts with them, is to say, no, lads. First of all, let's start being better for ourselves and each other. Yes. Let's get our own ship in order before we start helping other people. Because how can we be expected to have empathy and compassion for others when we've never had it for ourselves?
It's a muscle. You can only empathize so much with others that you can actually with yourself. And so if anyone happened to be jumping halfway into this conversation, you're mentioning that the statistics lean towards you being more likely to get attacked on the street than women. I believe an important distinction here is when you say that, you're not saying, so we don't need to be concerned or as concerned for women. We need to be more concerned for men.
Yeah.
Am I correct in thinking, believing you're not saying that?
Absolutely, yes. No, I'm absolutely. Okay. I'm saying that because to finish the point that I make, what I then say to the audience is, you're more likely to be the victim of stranger violence, but you're also most likely to be the perpetrator. So this is about us. This is not to say that we don't need to focus on violence against women and girls, because I also do that in my work. But in order to engage boys and men with this, we have to make it about them and their experience. Simply to say, you're all potential future rapists, which I know is a flippant way of distilling what the message, but so much of the work that is done in the sphere that we work in is done through a female prism, because the vast majority of people who do this sort of work are female, which is because of all of the socialization that we talk about, right? But the problem with that is, women go and sit in front of a group of boys and say this, this, and this, but the boys are like, you don't know what it's like to be us, which is why we need men to stand in front and say, well, I do know what it's like to be you, and I've made all of the mistakes, and I'm hopefully going to make all the mistakes so you don't have to. And my thing was, when I started to speak with schools, one, this amazing woman who I've worked with a lot with her school, she said to me, well, last week we had a talk on addiction, and we have a former addict come in to speak to the kids about addiction. She's like, as far as I'm concerned, you're just a former macho culture masculinity addict. And so you can speak about all of the mistakes that you've made and be honest about it with the kids. You know, I literally walk on stage and the first thing I say to them to get their attention is, I used to be an absolute dickhead, and I still am sometimes, and I'm not proud of that fact, but I'm going to prove it to you. And in proving it to you, I hope you'll understand why I'm here and why I do the work that I do. Like, I don't walk on stage and say, be more like me. I say, be less like I was. Be better than I was.
Yeah. For sure.
And that's where it's the Tony Porter thing of, we need to meet men where they're at.
Meet men where they're at and call them in, not call them out. Yeah. Which is another big message of his. So the reason why I wanted to stop for a second and bring up that point is, and I think that's something that perhaps you, I, and other men in this work can get better at doing, is that what I heard you say when you said that men statistically are more likely to get attacked on the street than women. Stats aside, that snippet right there. There's a snippet right there that someone can just boom, forget everything we said before or after and jump in on that. And so something I need to work on and want to work on is how do I best communicate to what I really believe in, which is helping the mental health of boys and men and helping them become better fathers, sons, citizens, brothers, partners, right? How can I communicate that in a way? Not saying it won't happen, not saying there isn't a million things in this podcast that people can't grab onto and cancel me over. But how do I communicate the both and, right?
Yes.
As opposed to the binary of we have it worse.
It's a really interesting point that for you, talking about these things, you are so, it's almost like you're on edge talking about them because of the fear of being misrepresented, right? So I was at a school the other day and some girls challenged me, as often is the case, about this very point. And they said, why is it that you're saying that we need to focus only on the male violence and not the violence against women? And I was like, I didn't say that. And they were like, but you said this. And I was like, yes, I said those statistics. I said that we as men are more likely to be the victims of violence than any woman ever will, right? In saying that, I didn't say, but that, and so therefore we shouldn't care about violence against women. But yeah, that was how it was interpreted by these two girls.
Sure.
And it's like, think about why you heard it that way, right? When all I'm saying is, this is just the facts. 67% of all violent crime in the UK is male-on-male crime. So I said to them, I'm saying these statistics to the boys in the room to help them to understand that they are also at risk from the same things you are at risk of. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, that violence, that male violence against men and male violence against women has the similar impact on the person who is experiencing the violence. But 400 men die every year at the hands of men. 200 women die every year at the hands of men. 4,000 men in the UK die at their own hand. So, like, this is a problem that impacts men. And in order to engage men, we can talk about the male experience. But this is where, as a man speaking up about these things, you can reap the whirlwind. And actually, recently I was at a school, and I say to the audience, look, I've sexually harassed women. I mean, I'm a 35-year-old man. Of course I have. Like, every adult man I know has sexually harassed a woman. Again,
guilty.
Pretty much every woman has sexually harassed a man at some point, but let's not play that game, right? I've also pinched girls' bums in nightclubs when I was younger. That's sexual assault. Like, let's not pretend otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so these girls took great offense to the fact that I was allowed into the school when I'd sexually assaulted people, even though I was using it to explain, like, that, you know, I don't have to explain that. You understand what I'm talking about, right? But
yeah.
So no, they complained to the school.
It's
they yeah. They complained to the school
you're,
about
you
it.
Were in the bucket. You're already in the bucket.
Yeah.
As to
yeah.
So yeah, on the list.
So they complained to the school about it, and they were like, "We don't want this man speaking in our school because he has been violent towards women." It was the same when my book came out, and I was taught, and I was very honest on the radio and stuff about the stuff I'd done to girls when I was at university and women at university. And then people were saying, like, this man shouldn't make a penny from this book, which I didn't. If anyone's a very low level author, they'll understand. This man shouldn't make any money from this. Every penny he earned should be donated to a women's sanctuary, whatever, all of this stuff, right? But then what happened was these girls, 16, 17 year old girls, they set up an account on Facebook. They found me on Facebook. They sent me illicit pictures of an underage girl and tried to tempt me into going having sex with this person, right? All in an attempt to
try to... These are girls from a school that you spoke at?
Yes. All in an attempt to discredit me and basically to try to honey trap me into doing something illegal, right? All because they determined that because I'm not perfect, that I shouldn't be allowed to do the work that I do. And this happened only like a couple of weeks ago. And actually, yeah, the school I was meant to be in. Yeah, anyway. This this is the thing. And it's like, how absolutely abjectly terrifying is that, right?
Absolutely.
People determine if somebody is not perfect, then they don't get to speak. And I'm I'm also going to talk about an experience that I had where I was going to speak on a police conference, right? Literally, the police were fine booking me for a conference after everything that happened, because there's no criminality recorded. Like, there's, you know, it's just conjecture and hearsay, and that's not how the world works. But there was a woman who I used to highly respect in this sphere in the UK. I'm not going to name them. And she was meant to be speaking on the panel as well, and she ended up complaining, and so the police cancelled me from the panel. And I reached out to her and said, like, I understand you have misgivings about me. Can we talk about it? And she said to me, and I have the messages to prove it. She said to me, let's say that this was a panel on racism, and let's say that somebody who professes to be anti-racist was accused of racism 5 years ago. That person should not be speaking on a panel about anti-racism. And I was like,
that person should be on the panel.
That's the precise person that we should be hearing from. The person, yes, who is trying to be better. But let's not pretend like that person isn't still racist in some way. Like, I am still sexist and misogynist because I was brought up to be. I try to be less and less of it every day, but every man is, just like all of us who are white are racist. All of us, yes, are homophobic. I'm bisexual and I'm still homophobic in many ways, like, because I was brought, yeah, up to be, right? So this is the thing. And she said, and then the real kicker was, she said, whether or not the allegation against them was true or false, they shouldn't get to speak. And it's just like, wow, that's where we're at now. And this is why so many men don't speak up. This is why straight people don't speak up about LGBT stuff. It's why white people don't speak up about issues of race, for fear of saying one thing wrong and being dragged, being shot down. Mm. And I feel myself getting angry now, so I need to calm myself down a little bit. Because that is the thing, yeah, that frustrated me so much.
Yeah. I feel the anger too, and what it's done is it's opened up a place in me to do some work, because I hear that story, and of course I only hear your side, but
yeah,
and only hearing your side, the story that comes into my mind is, does someone consider themselves infallible? Does someone consider themselves perfect to be in a position to talk about such issues? You were talking before about, feminist women saying that they should, it should be a woman standing in front of boys, teaching them about the impacts of, male dominance. But it's not going to land the same way it will as someone like yourself, who has been in the man box, who has been the perpetrator, right? And in the DEI, the diversity work that we do in MKP, there's a reason why a lot of those groups are led by white men.
Right.
Because it's... I learned this a little while ago, that when I started diving into my biases and my racism, I had, my group of black friends that I would say, hey, I'd like to get your support in my work around my racism. And of course, all of them said, sure. But what I didn't realize in the moment, what I was doing was, what I was saying is, hey, can you relive all the horrible shit that's happened to you under a race, right, basis, and help me as a white guy better understand my racism? Can, yeah, you do the work for me, please? And so if, yep, men aren't allowed to speak up and speak about these issues, then we're asking women to do all the heavy lifting, which they shouldn't.
Which they have been doing for generations.
Which they have been doing for generations, which is why men need to speak if it's something they believe in and they want to support and they want to be an ally. That's why they got to speak. That's why they got to own the ways in which they've been the perpetrator. Right?
Yeah.
Guilty, hand raised right here. Yeah. I want to own that so I can then give permission to that boy or man who has yet to truly face the and accept the true impact of their actions in the past that they're even aware of, to then begin their healing work, to in turn, number one, cauterize, stop behaving in that way. And then number two, pay that forward. Open the door and call in the next boy or man who may also be perpetrating those behaviors. it's not going to be as impactful. I'm not going to feel the call to action to do my work if someone points their finger at me and calls me a name and says I'm wrong in all these ways. When they haven't heard my story, they haven't heard my work, when they haven't gotten a chance to get to know the message behind what I was saying, whether I was delivering it terribly or not, there's no calling in. So I inherently then feel like my amygdala is going to take over from that point and whatever that's going to look like.
Mm. Yeah, you respond.
So I want to call people into these conversations.
Yeah. Precisely, because then you respond from a place of fear and shame, and that pushes you further away, actually. And that is the place where you do say something that you didn't really mean, right? Which is why it's taken me all of this time up until now to actually dare to speak, because I finally can speak with these things with a relative calm. You know, I'm checking my anger and frustration right now, which I'm entitled to feel, by the way. But so look, a lot of my work is like obviously theoretical based, but it's also done based on experience. And then I had an experience recently, which I think really speaks to what we're talking about right now, is that I was at a conference for a company, a really big construction company, and it was their equality, diversity, and inclusivity conference, right? And I was there speaking on behalf of 80% of your workforce are male, and yet you have nothing set up for men, right? You have women at company, LGBT at company. And I was there speaking on behalf of men, right? And then I said, one of the best things that you can do to start with would be to set up some men's groups within the company. And I can help with that. I'm trained in that. Like, that would be something that I would love to help you do. And then one of the women put their hand up and just said, well, we allow men into the women's network meetings. Would we allow women into the men's network meetings? And I said, I understand why that would be a point of contention, right? But the thing is that we as men have to start creating these spaces for ourselves first, because when the women's networks first started, they were exclusively for women. And then now they start to open up for men for reasons, because male allies will come and, you know, the three male allies in the business will come along every week and will join in. And I said, actually,
sure.
from my experience of this, if women are allowed into these spaces to begin with, then the conversations won't be as rich and deep and as healing as they can be. And I was in a room that was probably 50-50, male-female. And I reckon three women in the room started to debate this. And the CEO, the male CEO, just interrupted and said, hey, can I just say something? It's like, we're talking about men and male spaces. And the three women in the room are now having a debate about it. And the men are all sitting here terrified of speaking. And I was like, yes, brother. Like, that was the CEO going, hey, this is important. And I'm now going to work with that organization to run some mental health spaces for men. And it's like, yeah, and they will be male only for a time, right? Just for a time.
For a time. I mean, that's why I love the open, like, and one thing I've encouraged circles to do within MKP is do an open circle. Invite your wives, invite your girlfriends, invite your partners, invite your sisters. Do an occasional open circle. Do a check-in. Doesn't mean you have to go and do your deepest work. Because my experience of sitting in open circles, this is only my experience and only the circles I've sat in. The most uncomfortable people in those circles have been the men.
Yeah.
I initially would have thought, oh gosh, women would be quite terrified to be in this space, or, you know, would be the ones most uncomfortable in this setting. And it's not been mine. It's been men terrified for whatever reason. And so to encourage that inclusion, to encourage that because then otherwise, right, what happens in quiet and secret, it's so easily can become a boys club, right? But one thing we say in our circle all the time is, how are you going to take what you did tonight, what you learned tonight, how are you going to take that into the greater world? Because it's all good you doing your great work and feeling fantastic here in this sandbox, in this environment, but if you're not taking it out there, then what's the point?
Yeah. If you're not living and being the change. Yeah.
Go ahead.
as if you're not living and being the change, right, that you actually are talking. And the thing is, though, Brandon, we're all hypocrites, right? We all want to be better all the time, but we can't be. We're all fallible humans, as you've said.
Kintsugi, mate. You wear a kintsugi?
I'm what, sorry?
Are you aware of the art of kintsugi?
No, please enlighten me.
I am most certainly botching the pronunciation of that, but it's a Japanese art of repairing broken pottery
with gold. Yeah.
Bingo. And that's what I take from this conversation, is that every one of those experiences and really understanding that you're not always going to come away unscathed in these conversations, in these experiences. No. But those cracks will represent something. I believe you going through the experience you went through is going to open the doors and call men in. Now, are they going to be excited to have these conversations out loud? I would highly doubt it. But what you're doing is you're representing what it can look like in a healthy way. Those first steps. Opening the doors to those conversations. I'm grateful for you. I'm grateful for your experience. I'm going to ask you the miracle question. Magic wand. Where you are right now. Do you go back to that life of the documentaries and what was to come? Or are you sitting where you're sitting right now?
I don't need to answer that because I've already answered it, right? There's a man in my life who I don't speak to as much as I would like, and he's my oldest brother, Martin. And he's a very, very thoughtful, doesn't wear his heart on his sleeve, considered human, and is... He and I could not be more opposites. I'm the extrovert, center of attention, gobshite, right? Gobshite is a northern English term for loudmouth. And he reached out to me at the time that it all happened. And he just said, listen, Chris, I'm going to ask you a question right now. He's like, I give you the opportunity to go back and... You can choose not to repost that video that had such an impact on so many men and women at the time. And I give you the chance to go back and you don't repost it, right? Or you repost it and everything that you've experienced happens again. What do you do? And now he knew the answer to this, right? Because he knows who I am as a person. And so he's laughing when he asks me. And I'm like, you know the answer, Martin. He's like, yeah, I do. But tell me. I was like, you know I'd repost it and I'd reap the whole same whirlwind again. Because what I did was right. So I have no regrets about reposting that video. Mm. I would do it again in a heartbeat. Because I understand the impact it had on so many individuals. And the positives outweighed the negatives. You know, the negatives for me were great, but the positives impact it had on the discourse in the UK at the time were also great. And I don't say that again with any ego. It's just a fact.
Yeah.
And so there's no doubt in my mind. I would do it all again. And I would go through all of the shit that I went through. And I would be sitting here having the same conversation with you. And I would be... in a relationship with the most wonderful human who I meet on the richest, deepest level of human interaction that I didn't know was possible, because I am now capable and willing to be that authentic self because of my experience and the deep work that I've done. And thank you, Sina, for giving me the encouragement to do this, because she has been one of the big people saying, like, you know, You have the words, you have the tools, and encouraging me to do that, because she's magnificent. And I don't have any regrets. I don't have the I guess the biggest regrets in terms of reposting it, I guess the biggest regrets that I have where I wish I could have responded better at the time, but I responded authentically, and my authentic response was to dive into the depths of despair, and I had no control over that. You have no control over the impact that things can have on us, and it had an impact that I didn't realize I could experience something so dark. But yeah, I'd do it all again if I had to, because I helped, and that's all I've ever tried to do.
And if not you, then who?
Right, which is why I'm here talking to you about this today, because there are men who work in this sphere. I'm not the first. I know Michael Kimmel and other people have gone before me who have gone through similar things. I won't be the last. But I hope, articulated today something. I don't want to paint myself as a victim. I don't want to paint myself as a saint. I want people to understand that instances are nuanced, and people's experiences of the same incident are different, and that there is no right, there is no wrong, there is just human experience, and we're all trying to do our best, and I will continue to try to help the best that I can. And if people want to stop me from helping, then they are entitled to do so. But if they start to harass me, then they're being hypocrites too. And I will not stop. And like I said to my partner, I said, I'm not sure you can get cancelled twice, but maybe I can. Maybe after this I'll get cancelled again. And I said, if that's the case, I will just retreat into my therapy practice and just work with men one-to-one for the rest of my life. And if that's the case, I'll still be helping. And I'll still be doing the work that I love. I'll just be doing it on a smaller scale. And for me, it's as simple as that.
Beautiful. Well, Chris, one final thing I'll say just from me to you is my gratitude that you didn't fall into the comforts and safety of those men's groups that were going to just feed you what you wanted to hear when you were experiencing all of this, right? The red pill, guys. I'm grateful that you didn't do that, because I can only imagine if I was in your shoes that I'd have been like, oh man, finally a break from people that aren't just dicking on me all the time when it comes to this stuff and this work. And that's something I've seen other people in this space just dive headfirst into, and I've witnessed them become quite extreme. People whom I previously thought had quite reasonable messages that you could pull some gold from are now just so, in my judgment, polarizing and binary in their messaging.
Yeah.
And zero sum. Yeah, well, and so I'm grateful to you that you didn't.
I was never going to go there because actually some of the most supportive people at that time were the women in my life, to say, you want to believe women, believe us. We know that you're not this person. I think of my friend Annie, Nana, Adele, my mum, like wonderful, wonderful women in my life who I'm so fortunate to know, who continue to support me to this day. And all of my boys too, who were just fantastic, right? So fantastic. And never once did it cross my mind that I was going to start hating women and feminist narratives and rhetoric, right? Like, I still believe in the messaging. I don't believe that feminism has all the answers. I don't believe anybody has all the answers. I don't believe that anybody is 100% right or 100% wrong. I believe that to be alive is to be complex, and it is this thing that we do is crazy, but I wasn't going to be dragged into those spaces. I maintain that we as humans all have our privileges, and we all have our blind spots, but we also all have problems. And if we discount that men have problems, then we are not going to help men to escape from those issues that actually affect everyone in society, as we all well know. And that's why, for me, the zero-sum game mentality is not helpful, because to help boys and men out of their pain and their suffering is to help everybody out of a lot of pain and suffering.
That's it, mate. We can only do our part with the groups of people that we're going to have the greatest impact for. And we get to indirectly impact those others too in doing that work. So,
can I say this as well? That,
of course,
I've just put a post up on Instagram, right? And I've just started on Instagram. And my thing is, we hear all the time that, you know, men need to talk more, right? That men need to talk more. And I understand where that comes from, but I think that we're missing a step, right? And that step is that actually, as men, we need to learn how to listen to each other and create the space for the conversations to happen. And to everybody who is listening today, you have the most incredible example in Brandon. You are so compassionate and thoughtful and space-holding that's why I trusted you with this. And I trusted my intuition, because I've heard you hold these spaces before, and your capacity to do this is a shining light, and we can learn so much from the space that you create, and that Boyson creates, and that some of the other amazing men create, right? So I know that I have the words, and I can talk and talk and talk. I aspire to be able to listen as well as you do and to hold that space, because that's the key to this change, is that you have met me tonight without judgment, without making me feel like I am needing to be defensive. You have met me with the unconditional positive regard that is required in these spaces for the proper conversation to happen. And so to you, I say that I will never be able to thank you enough for being the person who gave me the space to speak about this in the way that I have done. So thank you so much, Brandon. I will never be able to repay that to you. So thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. I'm going to replay that for my wife. I go, see, babe, I'm a great listener.
I'm sure she disagrees.
Yeah. Some of the time. Selective, some perhaps. Of the time. Selective, perhaps. Yeah. But, man, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. I'm glad that I could listen, because I felt uncomfortable at many points during this interview, realizing just how much more work there is for me to do around a lot of this, and which is exciting, which is why I do this. I mean, I've been exposed left and right and every which way in this show, and it's always given me an opportunity to grow, and I can only do that by having men and women like yourself come on the show and lead the way by helping guide me and in turn helping guide the listeners as well. So I will take that, I will accept that, I will allow that to be truth. And man, I appreciate you sharing that. Before we wrap up, how can we find out more about you, Chris? Now you're getting back out there, getting back in schools. Where can we find you?
So you can find me at M for men, m-path.co.uk, .co.uk is the website where I run my program from now. You can find me on Twitter, if that is still alive and kicking, and is, I mean, I Twitter is a dumpster fire. So I'm at HEMMCH on Twitter, but I'm actually starting out on Instagram with some little reels and some, yeah, just putting some stuff out there. It's Empath Men on Instagram. So if that is your bag, please let me know. If you want to get in touch with me, if you're interested in me working with your businesses, I work online no matter where you are in the world. If you work in a school, likewise, but I do in person in schools. If you're interested in having me as your therapist or your coach, you can also get in touch with me through my website or any means that you want. But more importantly, I don't mind if you follow me or not. What I actually want is for you to go and have a difficult conversation today with the men in your life, because if you can start having the difficult conversations before things get too difficult, when the shit hits the fan, you'll be ready for it.
Mm.
That's, for me, is the most important thing.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. Fantastic, Chris. Well, to those listening, those links will all be in the show notes. And, you know, you are correct. Twitter was a dumpster fire when you hopped off. Now it's a cesspool. Leaps and bounds. Leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
For that platform. So have fun on there. Yeah. Good on you for being brave enough to jump on there. For those joining us, again, this has been another episode of the Mankind Podcast, the show where we break the molds of modern manhood to prove that there's more than one way to be a man. And we do that by talking with amazing blokes like Chris, leaning on those skinny branches and touching some of those taboo topics that you can't necessarily have at the dinner table, or you don't feel like you can with some of your mates or in your workplace. So hopefully we have taken perhaps the first step for you. The rest is up to you. Lots of love. We'll see you next week. This has been the Mankind Podcast, produced in association with the Mankind Project USA. I have been your host, Brandon Clift, and I personally want to thank our guests for joining us today and imparting their wisdom from their experiences in this amazing journey called life. And if you've been enjoying the music throughout this episode and all of our episodes, check out Jim Donovan and the Sun King Warriors. I have links to them in the show notes. Now, the fee for this episode is simple. If you found gold and insights that you believe could benefit your loved ones and those you care about, be sure to share it with them. And of course, remember that life doesn't happen to us, it happens for us, so long as we rip the pen out of fate's hand and become the author of our own story. So my friend, pick up the pen and we'll see you next week. Lots of love.